They're coming to get you, Secundo. When there's no more room on an iPod, the dead radio programs will walk the airwaves. Your podcasts of late have gone on far too long, at least for now. People do, in fact, have lives. So we'll give you 10 seconds this week to make your introduction.
No Jorge, then, I guess. Kids, this is Bat Segundo here. Must be quick. This week's guest is Jennifer Weiner. Her most recent book is Good Night Nobody. Must dash. It looks like they're boarding up the studio. Ta-ta!
First of all, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sure,
listen,
sure.
This is great.
Yes.
My first podcast.
No. You had a Simon & Schuster one,
well,
so I can't
take... My first non-house sponsored podcast.
Well, I've de-virginized quite a lot of the authors with this thing.
It's good for me so far, but please be gentle.
Okay, I will. I'm a gentleman. anyway, so I know that with this, Susan Isaacs is a big influence on you, and this is one of the things that sort of inspired you to dip your toe into the mystery genre. But I also was kind of amused at certain things, like, for example, the way you played with the sort of tough guy dialogue of, like, Lou Archer or, like, you know, Philip Marlowe. Yes, exactly. And he sort of shifted it to sort of this declarative sentences, and then yet at the same time was a sort of a suburban mom. So I'm wondering, aside from Isaacs, what sort of sources of inspiration did you have for this particular mystery? And I also wanted to ask, were Ayelet Waldman's Mommy Track Mysteries an inspiration?
I haven't read the Mommy Track Mysteries, and I didn't want to going into this because you just never want to read anything that's too close to what you're attempting.
Yes.
But as far as mysteries, I mean, I've read Philip Marlowe, I've read Dashiell Hammett, I've read Jonathan Kellerman, I've read Ruth Rendell, and lots of sort of British cozies. And also, I think I was really influenced by Zoe Heller's What Was She Thinking, which is not exactly a mystery, but very noir, very sort of a woman's story of terrible doings. Mm-hmm. And I was influenced by that. And I knew I wanted to write about motherhood. And I knew that I wanted to write about this woman who feels very out of place in her new surroundings and the whole fish out of water thing. And she's not fitting in with the other mommies. And I figured... There's no better way to galvanize a plot than a dead body on a kitchen floor with a knife in its back. So that was sort of the inspiration.
Well, the other thing about the dead body is, like, it's very specifically placed. You have the knife between the shoulder blades, and that seemed to be so precise, yet also so odd to some degree.
The knife between the shoulder blades and the body that's between the Viking range and the Sub-Zero refrigerator.
Yes.
I wanted to locate everything very specifically in a very identifiable suburban milieu.
Yes.
Sort of a nod to Edith Wharton, where she would describe the silver on the table and what kind of hunting bird they were eating and the linen napkins and the ladies' gloves and stuff like that. I wanted to really locate things precisely in a place that was at once... very recognizable, but very much satirized. Or at least I thought I was being satirical.
The shoulder blade struck me almost as mythological to some degree. You know, I was trying to like say, but maybe I was reading too much into it.
Well, it was basically stabbed in the back.
Yes.
Stabbed in the back by somebody you would let into your house and then feel comfortable enough to turn your back on.
Yes.
So, but the interesting thing for me with this book, one of the interesting things for me with this book is a lot of the things that I thought were very over the top are not being read that way at all. Mm-hmm. I had a reading yesterday here in San Francisco at a clean, well-lighted place for books, and there was this woman saying, you know, I really identified with the pressure to be this kind of mother, and I remember the guilt and shame I felt when I canceled my cloth diaper service and just started using disposables, and I'm looking at her like, you felt shame and guilt because you canceled your cloth diaper service. I mean, you know, I feel shame and guilt when I, like, ignore my kid for an hour and a half and park in front of a Maisie video. So I guess it's a little different in Philadelphia. But the other thing going on in Good Night Nobody is there's this...
You must have had the burrito crowd there.
Yeah. The Berkeley moms.
Oh, yeah.
But the scene where Kate talks about one of her neighbors who is not using diapers at all with her child, who's doing elimination communication, where she tries to suss out when her four-month-old might have to go, and then races to put him over what used to be a salad bowl... I did not make this up. This is something that's actually happening. And
really?
I was on the Today Show 2 weeks ago, these moms with these squirmy little newborns that they're like, oh no, we don't think it's good to teach children to eliminate in diapers. We really think they need to, you know, it's not sanitary and women throughout the ages. And I have to confess, I was sitting there rooting for the kids to pee on Matt Lauer. I was just like, come on.
He has it
coming.
Yeah,
and Matt was like, okay, one of those babies is looking a little squirmy. I'm like, come on, do it, you know, just because... not because Matt particularly deserves it, but because as the mother of a 2.5-year-old who's still sort of working on the potty thing,
yeah.
It's like, how much more do I need to feel inadequate about that my newborn isn't toilet trained? You know, it's like bad enough to have a toddler that isn't. But
yeah. It's
just funny because when I wrote that part of the book, some of the critics were like, oh, this is Weiner's, you know, satirical over the top, demonstrating her understanding of the bizarre. And I'm like, no, people are doing that.
Yeah,
people are doing that.
The truth is often stranger than fiction.
Truth is stranger.
Well, anyway, I also wanted to also note that, getting back to the sources of inspiration, the tough guy dialogue sort of inversion, I really like quite a lot.
Thank you.
And I was wondering if there was, because you even had it down to the commas, which I thought that was really, really amusing.
Well, I did my homework, but really I think that Susan Isaac's compromising positions was the mother of this book, where again, it's a woman in the suburbs who had been in the city, who had had a career, who's now home with kids and feels herself very lost. And not happy in her marriage, not happy in her role as mother, winds up solving a crime. And the mystery runs on two tracks, the way it does in my book, where there's the crime to be solved, but also the greater mystery, which resonates, I think, for a lot of readers, a lot of women readers, is like, how the hell did I get here?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Can I ever get out?
Yes. Got you. Well, you're also returning to the first person for the first time
since Good in Bed.
And I was wondering, does this sort of indicate, perhaps subconsciously, that you're embarking on something altogether new? Or?
Well, I think that with the first person, when you have a narrator as singular as Kate, you want to let her speak in the I voice. But the limits of the first person narration are that you wonder, how much do I trust this narrator? And Kate is a classic unreliable narrator. She is textbook unreliable. Mm-hmm. Her perceptions of the world and the way that she is received in it do not line up with reality. She walks into this playground and thinks, everybody's looking at me.
Yeah.
Nobody thinks I'm good enough. Oh my God, I'm fat. Nobody's thinking any of that. And she finds that out at the end of the book, where she believes that she's been judged, and in fact, she's the one who's been doing all the judging.
Yes, yes.
So I knew that I wanted to sort of play with that idea also. But first person's very easy for me. I mean, the truth is, all of my books were originally written in first person. In Her Shoes,
really?
Yes, In Her Shoes and Little Earthquakes, I changed them after the first draft. I went back and just revised the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's hard. I felt for John Irving when
he
had to
go
back
and
do that
John
with
Irving.
Until I Find You. Thank God I've never written an 800-page book. I'm sure there's many critics out there saying, yeah, thank God you haven't.
Well, beyond the fact that Goodnight Nobody is also a mystery, I also detected, sort of a broadening of your observations. You've got, for example, the perceived safety of suburbia.
Yes.
You've got, like, the ethical dilemma of whether husband or wife being married to someone who is working or employed by a corrupt politician.
Right.
You've got, like, the moment in the train where these urbanites are unwilling to give up their seats.
I know.
and these are things, I think, that sort of struck me as sort of, efforts to kind of, I guess, expand beyond the so-called, you know, we won't mention the word, the woman's issue.
Oh, say it,
yes,
say it.
Yes, the so-called chick lit formula, which I don't view anything named after a gum is highly suspect.
Well,
but.
And when you're my age, anybody calling you chick is pretty okay. You know, it's like I get ma'am most of the time, so I'm really okay with chick. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I wanted a bigger canvas to work on. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about more. I mean, I think that all of my books deal with the world that the heroines find themselves in to some extent, where... Yeah. If you look for it, there's commentary about gender relationships. There's commentary about the realities of the workplace. There's comments about the expectations of the bridal industry, for example. with the weddings and In Her Shoes and Little Earthquakes. But with this, I really did want to talk specifically about mothering and motherhood and what makes a good mother and how punishing the standards have become.
Mm-hmm.
And to talk about sort of urban versus suburban and what happens when you relocate and identity and connection and family and all that stuff. But yeah thank you for noticing that.
Well, yeah, the marriage is a very interesting.
Ah, the marriage.
It's the whole sort of, it really, really sort of strikes a chord because I see other men doing this to their wives or their girlfriends where, you're just a housewife and all this and just, not even thinking of the ramifications of
and
those statements.
The thing of it is, I think that Ben in Goodnight Nobody could have very easily become sort of a mustache twirling villain, ready to strap her to the train tracks. he's not a bad guy.
Yeah.
He's a busy guy.
Yes.
He's perhaps an ethically compromised
guy. Oh, yeah,
guy.
I understood.
Right.
But it was also very interesting how you don't portray him necessarily as a bad guy, but he's a man who says these things,
mm-hmm.
and he's just totally just not even cognizant of the effect that it's having. It's like the minute he says it's like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. And, you know.
There's been a lot of famous feminist writing about this.
Yes.
I think that Arlie Hochschild's, I think she was the one that wrote The Second Shift about even working women carry the burdens of the family.
Yes.
They're the ones who do the scheduling. They're the ones who set the social calendar. Mm. They're the ones in charge of enrolling the kids in school and signing the permission slips and making the lunches and doing the laundry. And it's sort of, I wanted to look at the question of my generation. I'm 35, born in 1970, raised on Free to Be You and Me, and, you know, mommies are people. Right. People with children. And the idea that there was supposed to be a reckoning,
mm-hmm.
there was supposed to be a shift, there were supposed to be these marriages of equals where daddy would do diapers and mommy had a briefcase, and there was supposed to be... it wasn't supposed to be like this. It wasn't supposed to be where Kate, who has these 2 degrees from Columbia and a career in magazines, winds up doing laundry and dishes and carpooling. And the most intelligent conversations she's having are for the 5 minutes she can catch her best friend on the phone.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to think about that and to sort of hold that marriage up and say, something happened here that wasn't supposed to happen. It's not supposed to still be this way.
Yes. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts about how we bridge the divide. Over the years, outside of romances, you know, we've seen pretty much women readers have to, like, read the men going on about their angst and all their stuff. And all you really get is all essentially throughout the course of literature, like, the consolation prize of, like, Elizabeth and Darcy.
Yes.
You know, so... at the same time, I'm a man, and if I see sort of a pink cover...
Yes, you are.
Yes, I am a man. And I see a pink cover with, like, high heels on it, and I say to myself, do I need to read that book? But if I read the book, I'm like, okay, I understand this. I'm down with it. So how do we sort of bridge this divide so that it's not exclusively women who read your... I mean, it isn't exclusively women, but I'm saying the majority of your readers are... probably women.
Although that's true of all fiction.
Yes.
I mean, women read the vast majority of fiction. So I think that the idea that, oh, let's go for a male audience, it's like, do we need to? You know, do we have to? I mean, the covers are definitely an obstacle. Like,
yes.
I'm not going to lie. You put naked legs and cheesecake on a cover and not... It is a brave man who will read that book in public.
Yeah.
Who will buy that book.
I read your book. I read the book with the cover
God,
in public.
God
yes.
bless you.
Yes. On the bus, on the subway.
God bless you.
I got some looks myself.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that if publishers were serious about appealing to a broader audience, they wouldn't have covers like that.
Yeah.
But I think that they've recognized that their bread and butter and their money is coming from women readers, and they don't feel a need to change it. I mean, you know, in terms of critical perception, I wish I could think of some smart way to make the New York Times book review take Chick Lit a little more seriously. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that the way that they handle other genre fiction, the way that they handle romance and mysteries, they do roundups. It's sort of like Entertainment Weekly does Chick Lit 101 every couple of weeks, where it's like, okay, here's 4 books and here's a little capsule and here's what we think. I don't think that's such a bad way to handle it. I think that it's a way of saying, okay, there are elements of formula in these books. There's sort of the sassy, spunky, sarcastic first-person narration, probably some romantic issues, maybe dysfunctional family, possible gay best friend or dog.
Yeah.
And I have to say, if I were a gay man, I think that would be the most offensive part of Chick Lit, is the idea that, like, it's either a gay guy or a dog.
Yeah.
Not both. Gay guy, dog. It's like, okay, so basically I am the literary plot equivalent of a Malty. Like, that's just, you know, that's just, you know, it's me or the little schnoodle or whatever those dogs are. I mean, are men going to read these books? What I find with my books is women choose them and men have them thrust upon them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Patty and Selma on The Simpsons with celibacy.
Yeah.
Like, one of them chose a life of celibacy and one had it thrust upon her.
Yes.
I think that guys get my books sort of handed to them by the women in their lives and say, you know, read this if you want to understand what I'm going through, kind of thing. And the guy's
how many boyfriends or husbands read this in an effort to sort of, you know, understand, too, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure guys are ever going to say, ooh, get me that new Lauren Weisberger, get me that new Candace Bushnell, get me the new Jennifer Weiner. But At the end of the day, I'm not sure how much it matters. I mean, certainly it matters in terms of the cultural debate about what's literature, what's schlock, what's important, what should be considered. But I also think that present-day readers aren't the judge of that. History is.
Yeah.
And 100 years from now, it would not surprise me at all to see Bridget Jones in the canon as, you know, an example of this is the way the world was then.
Yeah.
Which is why we read a lot of fiction. Old fiction.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
So.
But at the same time, though, I mean, I think what distinguishes your work from, say, other chick lit authors and what draws me, someone like me to it,
uh-huh.
some strange man like me, to, I try to read as widely as I can, but your stuff is very observational and very, very good at sort of portraying female perspective
uh-huh.
in a way that is inherently valuable and refreshing.
Well, thank you.
Yes, you know, my sister, by the way, is a huge fan of yours.
Oh, that's so
yes.
nice. Yeah. That's really nice. I mean, because it's so funny. It's like, I read Philip Roth and
yeah.
come away terrified because I think probably that is what men are really like a lot of the time. It's like,
yeah.
ooh, lock up your liver.
Well, not entirely. It's,
I know.
It's just thought process. But I mean, the thing is to counter a Philip Roth, Portnoy sort of thought process
mm-hmm.
with the female equivalent of that.
Right.
And to sort of, I guess what I'm, my main sort of idea here is that how do we sort of make it so that chick lit isn't even a label? Why does it even have to be a label? You know, I mean,
yeah.
Do we begin a canvassing campaign? Do we spread leaflets into the street? It's
read
just
this,
a pink cover.
Read this, it won't hurt.
Yeah, exactly.
It won't hurt, we
yeah.
promise. I mean, here's the thing, though. I mean, ever since Nathaniel Hawthorne was complaining about the damned mob of scribbling women,
yeah.
women's fiction has always been devalued.
Yeah.
It was ever thus. And I don't know if it's ever going to change. I mean, I think that there are a select few group of women who can make it through, mm-hmm. and usually they're not writing in this genre. They're writing sort of speculative fantasy. They're like Judy Budnitz or Amy Bender or Kelly Link, who
yeah.
are, I adore all of them.
Yes.
They're doing wonderful things. Or it's, for whatever reason, and I guess I'm thinking about Curtis Sittenfeld, even though I try not
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I was going to mention her at
yeah,
one point.
Yeah, but it's like if you go to the right school and you get the right boys to blurb you, and
yeah.
if you review books for the New York Times, then the New York Times will maybe think that your book is okay and different somehow than all those like chicky books with pink covers.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think how to change it.
In other words, the stigma specifically here mm-hmm. is against popular literature.
Yeah.
Like Margaret Atwood can go ahead and transcend not only the fact that she writes about women's issues, but also science fiction.
Yeah.
And now
and being Canadian,
yes.
which I think you'll agree with me is the
yes.
hugest stumbling block of all. But with Cat's Eye, I mean, Cat's Eye had elements of fantasy to it, but it was a pretty straight up kind of women and relationships
yeah.
book. But she's literary. Or like Carol
yeah.
Shields or
oh,
Anne
yeah.
Tyler, people who write about the sort of intimate territory of marriage and family and choices and stuff like that. I guess, I mean, I don't know. Is it the name brands? Is it the high heels? Is it the sort of wish fulfillment, happy ending? I don't know. I guess I haven't thought so much about how to change it because I have to sort of content myself with the realities of the marketplace. And
yeah.
in the realities of the marketplace, my books do just fine.
Yeah.
You know, never gotten that New York Times review, never gotten
yeah.
that Oprah pick, but women readers respond to what I'm doing. And that gratifies me more than any of that other stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah.
you know.
Okay. Oh, I wanted to ask, because I'm a single urban male, what spawned
uh-huh.
the ugly doll thing?
I mean,
was this an effort to keep, like, sort of really sort of down with the kids, culturally current, or did you sort of see kids playing with these ugly dolls?
What happened? Somebody gave my daughter an ugly doll.
Okay.
This is
okay.
what happened.
I was mystified. I know nothing of these
yes,
things. Please
well,
educate
if you,
me.
If you had a child, you would probably,
yes.
if you had a child and lived in a big urban center,
yeah.
ugly dolls are these. They're ugly. They're
mm-hmm.
they're plushy stuffed toys that are sort of, they feel like, you know, oh, cute little teddy bear. And then you look at it and it's got like buck teeth and yellow eyes. And it's like, ah, they're very cute, but in an ugly way. They're grotesque.
Oh, one is back on the
There's
back
on
cover
the back
too.
Of Goodnight
yes.
Nobody. That's
yes.
an ugly doll. So somebody gave my daughter Lucy an ugly doll and she was like 9 months old. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to give this to her. It's kind of scary, but mm-hmm. she loved it. She loved it. And she's like, ugly doll, ugly doll. So like, I loved that this would be the toy that the daughter in the book would have
sure.
and the one thing that she needs and can't live without is her ugly doll. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of threw it in there. It's a little nod to my own daughter, I guess. But yeah, they are huge. In big cities, I think that probably women in middle America are like, what is that? I don't want that. But they're very cool.
Okay. Okay. Cool. I want to talk about Laura Lynn Baird.
Yes.
Now, obviously, there was this, you know, the slinky blonde, you know, definitely.
Pundette.
Yes, exactly. Ann Coulter. But I got a sort of distinct kind of Caitlin
Flanagan
vibe.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. She was not meant to be... Ann Coulter. She was meant to be sort of a spin on Caitlin Flanagan. And I don't know what Caitlin Flanagan looks like, but
yeah,
I...
Who does? We just see her vile articles.
Her vile articles, yeah. Right. I mean, I read her piece about nannies right when I had started working again and have a nanny so I can go get a couple hours writing done every day. And I really had a very visceral reaction to it. And the first reaction I had was, of course, overwhelming guilt, because she said... If you have anybody else taking care of your child for even part of the day, that is a love bond, and your child is giving love to somebody who should be you and is receiving love from somebody who should be you. And I was like, you know, it really was a...
Well, we all had visceral reactions to
this. Right. I mean, it was a terribly punitive thing to read. And I'm not saying that I'm such a moral relativist that, like, you know, oh, it's okay, you know, lock your kid in a closet for 8 hours with a videotape, and that's fine if that's how you want to choose to mother. But
Given, like, the realities of maintaining a career.
Exactly.
You know?
And, I mean, I'm also coming at it from the perspective of my own family, which is my parents split up when I was 16, four kids in my family. And my mom went from being somebody who... probably fit Caitlin Flanagan's definition of a woman who works for, you know, cocktail party cred to have something to talk about, which also struck me as bizarre, because I don't know any mom with little kids who's going to cocktail parties. It's like, we're going to birthday parties, you know, we're on the Elmo Princess
circuit. You haven't seen those, like, midget chaperones? Right?
But
an 8-year old escorted me at the party the other night.
Right. See, there you go. But I mean, my mom went from somebody who worked because she chose to somebody who needed a job, needed a paycheck. You know, my father just decided he had better things to do with his money than support his four kids. And so we were 16, 15, 13, and 9, and she needed a job. And I just remember thinking, do the women who need jobs really need one more person telling them that they're letting their kids down and letting all of womanhood and all of motherhood down?
Particularly when they have all these sort of balls that they're juggling.
Exactly. And to be told it from a woman who is so privileged that she, first of all, as any writer will tell you, has the best gig in the world for a mother, because you can write when the kid naps, you leave for a few hours, you write at night. The kid, I mean, it's not like you're going into an office and having a boss and having set hours. You're a writer, you know?
And she writes for the Atlantic and the New Yorker, too.
Exactly.
So it's not
This really privileged woman, sort of, you know, from the perspective of her own parenting, where she had a stay-at-home mom, sort of sitting in judgment of every other woman who made a different choice and saying, you're wrong, and your kid will suffer, which was the implication. That felt like an idea that I wanted to address.
Okay.
So basically, I killed Caitlin Flanagan in this book.
With a very precise shoulder blades.
Right.
Thing. Yeah.
I mean, I initially, that was one of the big changes I went through in revisions, was Laura Lynn Baird, that character, the conservative critic, was actually the murder victim.
Yeah.
And one of my editors read it and came back and said, not only, this woman is so loathsome that not only do we not care who killed her, we want to kill her ourselves, which I realized as I went on was sort of a problem in a mystery. Like, you just can't have it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have a little something there, something sympathetic with your victim, so people do want to figure out who killed her. But I mean, I think a lot about mothering and good mothering and how do you define it, and does it mean, you know, can you work, and if you have kids, should you just be home all the time? And I tried that, and I about went crazy, and I needed to work, and I love what I do. So that was my choice, and it's worked out well for my family. I mean, Lucy has a really good nanny, and she's cared for part of the day by someone who knows what she's doing. Mm-hmm. And if Lucy winds up in a relationship where she's giving and receiving love to someone who isn't me, I just don't think that's such a terrible thing. I mean, there's lots of people in the world who love her, and that's not so bad.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one more person to love.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to sort of go back to, we were talking about precise details at the opening of this particular conversation. Since this is a mystery, obviously it's going to be riding a lot more on plot. How obsessive were you with the precision on this?
With the...
More with this book.
Oh, well, this book was more work than anything I've ever done. I think that my agent and I figured out, my agent who's my first reader and my editor, that generally you write a first draft and you revise and you revise and you revise, and about 50% of what was in your first draft winds up in the final product.
Yeah.
With Goodnight Nobody, I think that maybe 10% of what I wrote in the first draft wound up in the final version, because I just kept moving things and changing things and working on the plot and working on the pacing and working on the details and working on the clues and figuring out, you know, when to reveal what and how much of your hand to show.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a very fine balance with mysteries where you want to give your readers enough so that they feel that they can legitimately be trying to figure things out along with your sleuth, but not so much that they get it by chapter three and are like, oh, enough of this.
Yeah.
So
did you sort of work out the plot details in the process of sort of writing the draft on a laptop?
Yes, that was what I did. I wrote a draft on a laptop, and then I went back and did an outline. And then I went from the outline and did note cards. And then I spent a couple of days moving the note cards around. And I worked with a couple of different editors. This one guy named Ken Salikoff, who only edits mysteries. And then my editor at Atria, who's Greer Hendricks. And then my agent, Joanna Pulsini. And just rewrote and rewrote and rewrote and rewrote. And I think I learned a lot doing this book. I think it'll be a little while before I do another mystery. But I loved it.
Yeah.
I really did. It was a challenge. And I don't want to be the kind of writer who just does the same thing over and over and over again. Even though I think that a lot of my readers are like, we want the next Good in Bed. We want the Good in Bed sequel.
Yeah.
You know, we want Canny in Europe, you know, or whatever. But like, I want to push myself and do different things, like Margaret Atwood, who's always sort of, you know, sort of genre bending and doing dystopia and doing horror and doing romance and just doing everything.
Well, Stephen King is a big influence of yours.
And
he recently, you know, put out The Cincinnati Kid.
Yes.
And maybe perhaps a way to sort of, I guess, expand the audience and be taken more seriously. Have you contemplated actually like writing a purely literary small house title or something like that?
Wow. No one's asked me to.
Oh, okay.
The thing I get asked a lot about is YA, and I would love to do that someday. But Stephen King is interesting because he was somebody who got zero critical respect for about 20, 25 years.
And then he's
published
in
The New Yorker.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's hope for me.
Yeah.
I might have to get hit by a van at some point, but I'm thinking that, you know, I'm going to keep pushing.
Maybe
someday.
A Mack truck just to seal the deal.
Well, I'm thinking a Vespa. You know, that would be
okay. Oh, that would be really good.
That would be really good, yeah, because I'd be hit by something hip and trendy and probably not injured very badly, so that's what I'm going for. Vespa.
Okay. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask about, just really quick about Goodnight, is that there seemed to be a lot of handshaking of Kate. I picked up, but it seemed that every single time that she was nervous, her hands shook.
Yes.
And I'm wondering why there was no other real tick aside from handshaking to sort of display her nervousness.
Well, I wanted her to pick her wedgie, but my agent was like, no.
I was going to ask if there were limitations here in place.
Well, you know what? There is a... probably it's because my hands shake when I'm nervous, so I probably just gave her that. But there is a sexual act described in this book that I had to fight so hard for.
You had to fight for that? Because it was hilarious.
Yeah, well, thank you. But like, there's a scene where Kate is fighting with her husband, and she's like, I haven't seen him so angry since that time on our honeymoon when I da-da-da-da. And every time I would submit the manuscript, my editor in New York, Greer, would send back a note with the words, ew, in the margin, just underlined like five times, like gross, you know?
Wow.
And I never cut it, and I would keep putting it in, and I finally called her up and I'm like, okay, listen, I know you've really got a problem with where Kate put her pinky, but listen, I'm not saying you have to do this. And she's like, uh-huh.
But
and
people
I'm like,
do these things.
And I'm like, I'm not saying I've ever done it. And there was a slightly more dubious, uh-huh. And I'm like, but people do these things.
Yeah.
It happens,
yeah.
You know? And it's very in keeping for Kate's character that she would do this and that her husband would react the way he did. And she was like, okay.
So, yeah. So how hard did you have to fight?
Real hard.
Jesus.
I went to the mat.
Wow.
I went right to the mat. Yeah, I mean, there's things that I will fight hard for. And then there's things where it's like I have to kind of let them go, like with the cover of the book, which I think is very vivid and visually compelling.
Yeah.
I wanted something more mysterious looking. Like we were talking about how do you appeal to men and
yes.
women. And I'm like, you got to stop putting like the chicks in pink on my covers.
Yeah.
But I wanted, I told them, I said, I want like an open door or a blowing curtain or something that conveys mystery.
Yeah.
I said, maybe a ghost. And they're like, how do we put a ghost on your cover? I'm like, that's your problem. Bye. But
you guys are the brilliant designers.
Yeah, well, the art department, like every time they see me coming, they all pretend they're out to lunch because when I wrote Good in Bed, they're like, do you have any ideas for the cover? And I'm like, I do, as it happens, have an idea for the cover. And they said, what's that? And I said, I think there should be a bed on the cover because, you know, get it? Good in Bed and there should be a bed. And they're like, okay. And then they all like backed out of the room very slowly. So, yeah, with this, I was just like, I want there to be something more mysterious. And we tried about, like, we had a different cover at BEA and just, like, everything. And finally they said, there needs to be a human element. There needs to be a human figure. And there needs to be something sort of echoing the coloring, the color scheme of your previous book. So I'm like, okay, here we go. Pink lady. And sure enough, that's what we got.
But going back to this issue of fighting for a very realistic sort of and funny scene.
Yes, thank you.
Do you feel that you are sort of, because your books sell X number of copies, that you have to fight longer battles to appeal to sort of a broader possible audience? How do you corral this sort of issue? Because it just seems to me that, that people come to you for scenes like that.
Yes, thank you.
And yet simultaneously,
I am the pinky in the ass girl. That's really, my mom is so proud.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I never want to be one of those writers, like, I guess Anne Rice is probably the most infamous example of, I have written my manuscript and here it is. Do not change a word.
First draft,
personally, Anne Rice, have labored over each syllable in this book, so don't tell me you've got a problem with it. Like, I listen to my editor and I listen to my agent and I listen to whoever I hire as my fresh eyes to kind of read the thing. And if somebody tells me they have a problem with something, I listen to them. And sometimes I'll say, I see your point. And sometimes I'll say, no, I'm sorry it's grossing you out, but this is a very, this is a detail that's very in keeping with the character I've created.
But simultaneously, if the notes coming back are not just a line edit for grammar, but when it's you, when it's a human moment, that's got to be a very frustrating sort of experience.
No, it's not frustrating.
I mean, you know.
I just sign over. So I signed my editor up for like the Dildo of the Month Club or something like that. But can I say Dildo of the Month on a podcast?
You can say anything you want. This is a podcast.
Shit, fuck, motherfucker. Oh God. But
keep going. Cocksucker. Everything.
Cocksucker, motherfucker. You know, I'm glad that my editors don't feel the need to hold back with me. Because I think that there are writers where it's like, well, she sold X number of copies and she must know what she's doing, so I'm not telling her shit.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that my editors will tell me this isn't working for me and here's why. Like, you know, I won the pinky in the ass battle, but like there's other things where it's like, you know, this relationship doesn't feel right or this scene could be tighter. Or
certainly. I understand that form of editing, but I guess what I'm sort of wondering about
if somebody
here,
writes you in the margin.
Well, if someone writes you in the margin, instead of sort of suggesting, well, you know, well, this makes the character more human.
Right.
This makes the issue more, you know, that you don't see in literature more prominent.
Right.
And so, you know, my question is whether, not necessarily if it contributes to the story, it adds character, then why is there a battle here? You know, I mean,
I guess it wasn't a battle so much as like, you know, I would turn the manuscript in and she would write ooh and I would laugh about it and not change it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a battle. It was a discussion where it was like, okay, I know this is grossing you out, but we're going to keep it and here's why.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what I really have fought for. You know, mostly Joanna, my agent, is the one who's like, this isn't working. This needs to be cut. This needs to be changed. And I'll have a day of being really indignant and like, well, how dare you? And I wrote it that way for a reason. And I'm right and you're wrong. And then I'll sleep on it and be like, okay, you're right and I'm wrong. Let me fix it.
Oh, sure. Sure. The issue, I guess, is sort of like, you know, if we were talking about bridging the gap, so using weird Clintonian terms. But basically, we were talking.
I did not have sex with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Wasn't he?
I saw her in a spa once.
Did you?
And I didn't say anything. But she has really beautiful skin. I was sort of starstruck in a way. It was like, oh my God, it's Monica Lewinsky. Look at that. Wow. Hi. Hi.
Well, I guess.
We were both in robes, too. I felt very vulnerable.
Anywho, but going back to this, I guess, you know, we were talking about bridging the gap, and I was sort of, I guess, sort of suggesting with this line of questioning that perhaps presenting more human moments might sort of appeal to all audiences. And
well, here's the thing. Okay, Jonathan Franzen can write a scene where somebody in the grips of Alzheimer and dementia.
The shit monster.
The shit monster.
Exactly.
And nobody writes ew in his margins.
I know. That's what I was
God
leading up
God damn it.
To.
Okay, now I'm pissed. Now I'm really
maybe the solution here is to turn in like an 800-page book.
So, I think the solution is for me to grow a penis. I mean, let's just put it right out there.
Yeah, okay.
Can you help me with that?
Well, we are in San Francisco. I know a few people we can pick
just
up.
Just down the street there,
Just down the hill. The In Her Shoes movie.
Yes.
Which I did, in fact, see.
Oh, good.
You know, and I did, in fact, enjoy it. But I want this is also a question that comes from my sister. Mm-hmm. I actually was on the phone with her. I said, hey, I'm going to be talking with Jennifer Weiner. I know you love her. What do you want me to ask her? This kind of comes from her.
Uh-huh.
But it also got me thinking about this question, too. And that is, the Rose character in the film, mm-hmm. as portrayed, as compared to the Rose character in the book. Toni Collette is nowhere to be seen in the movie poster. And in fact, the screenplay by Susanna Grant, which is does a remarkable job, I think, of economizing and making the time go by really fast.
Yes, right.
And I think it's actually, because it wasn't exactly the easiest book to adapt from a screenwriter standpoint.
No. But all those uncinematic old people.
Simultaneously, I was wondering, though, it seemed to me that Rose's character kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit in the film.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, we can talk about the poster.
Yeah.
In terms of the film, though, I actually think if you went through and clocked it, you would find that she got just as much screen time as Maggie did. Of course, Maggie's in Florida with this other character, so a lot of their scenes are together, but I didn't feel that way at all. I thought that Rose has some of the most important moments in the story. And when you have Cameron Diaz in the movie, the fear is that it's going to become the Cameron Diaz show. I don't think it did that, though. I really don't. And I think the reason it didn't is because they have the screenplay first.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a case of Cameron sort of attaching herself to the book and saying, okay, it's going to be Maggie's story and Rose can just show up every once in a while.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that was what happened in the movie. Now, the poster is a different story. And the poster is one of these things where I sort of stepped back and said, I have to believe that the marketing people know what they're doing here. I have to believe that if they put Cameron Diaz on what's called the one sheet, that they are doing it for a reason, that they know that this is what's going to get people in the theaters, and I'm going to trust them. Is it the decision that I would have made?
Well, we're talking Toni Collette. If you look at the poster for Muriel's Wedding, Toni Collette is on there.
Yes.
That film grossed in America 5 times the amount of the film's budget, just in the United States alone.
Right.
It's sort of very similar to how a lot of these studio executives kind of, are shocked. Every single time, like, say, a film that is geared towards African-American audiences, they're shocked that black people see movies.
Yes.
Even though, again and again and again, you see grosses.
Yes.
Likewise, it's interesting to me that, yes, women want to see their stories on screen.
Indeed they do.
And it just seems to me, utterly sort of ridiculous and hypocritical for them to, to market it almost against that demographic.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because I think they're thinking, okay, we have Cameron Diaz. Cameron Diaz is a huge movie star.
Yeah.
But I think that she's been a huge movie star in different kinds of movies.
Yeah.
And that if this were, I don't know, because it's not my job to sort of...
Sure.
I think that it's interesting because the film that they're... The poster that they're using to market this overseas is Cameron and Toni sort of sitting on a couch with the shoes and the little dog, and it looks very different.
Wow.
And then the poster they're using, or not the poster, but the image that they're using now in the newspaper ads is the three women in profile sort of standing side by side.
Yeah.
So they do have different images to use. I mean,
perhaps because the first image didn't work as well.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I can't explain Hollywood.
Yeah.
I just can't. And I love the movie that they made. And I, at the end of the day, I have to be really pleased about that.
Sure.
And just sort of...
Well, particularly since it's a Hollywood adaptation.
Exactly.
Too,
you know? I mean, like, I was so worried. Because when you're talking about a movie that has senior citizens in it, you have to start thinking, okay, are they going to just get rid of that plot line completely? Or instead of a long-lost grammother...
Grumpier old men.
You know,
grumpiest old men.
Right. And I was thinking, instead of their long-lost grandmother, what if it's their long-lost half-sister who's a stripper in Vegas?
Yeah.
You know, like, because that's a way. And then it's a road trip to, like, but... Yeah. I was very happy with the way they told this story. And, was I happy with every little detail of the marketing? Maybe not so much. But at the end of the day, it's a really good movie that I'm very proud of. So.
Even the decision to make Simon?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Simon. It's interesting because when I read the book, I sort of said, you know what? Simon is not... For me, anyway, he didn't strike me as manly enough. And then in the movie, they make him a Sixers fan.
Yeah, well, I think he was manly enough.
Well, I don't know. But
I invented him. I think he was really manly.
Okay, he's manly.
He's manly.
While you're in the room, he's manly.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, let's see. Oh, yes. But and also about that movie, what was it like to walk take after take behind Toni Collette and Brooke Smith?
You know, I have new respect for the work that actors do. It was freezing cold that day. Mm-hmm. It was, they had manufactured snow lining the streets. And like, I couldn't feel my toes after like the third take. And you're just doing it and doing it and doing it. And they're moving the lights and they're moving the boom mics and they're making these minute adjustments. And you do it over and over and over again. And it was at once surreal and exhausting.
You probably now are very well aware of the script supervisor.
And all the ADs and everything.
Yeah,
and
well, correcting all of your details and making
the
continuity
days.
Matches.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was a really unbelievable experience. And I have such respect for people in the film industry. Mm-hmm. Because when you're writing, it's you and your laptop making shit up.
Yeah.
And when you're doing a movie, it's hundreds of people.
Yeah.
Hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And a lot of money and a lot of things to deal with.
Sure.
So
sure.
Glad it's not me.
Okay. The other thing, I did a little bit of preliminary research, and in a Palm Beach Post interview, a journalist asked you what would happen with your work if you had personally decided to lose weight. And you said that you want to be consistent in your message that happiness can, in fact, be found for full-figured women.
Yes.
And I wanted to sort of take that question one step further and ask whether being a mother has had any influence upon conveying this consistent message to the many women who read your books, and of course men too. And if you want to desire to keep your message consistent, does this mean somehow a return to the plight of single women? Or, I mean, how do you corral these sort of two things?
Well, see, I don't think that motherhood is a magic bullet to anything. And it was funny. I got a lot of crap on one website for sort of this, like, you know, it was a
number
screed.
One
that one, where it was like, you know, and Jennifer Weiner promoting, you know, reactionary family values by posing with her spawn. And I was like, okay, listen.
Well, no, I don't think they said that. I mean, the anonymous person said anachronistic belief system.
Anachronistic belief system by posing with her child. And I'm thinking, John Irving just posed in People magazine with his wife and kid. Salman Rushdie had his wedding photographed by InStyle magazine. Okay, if you want to talk about people that are sort of pushing marriage by just having their picture taken, I think that, you know, I'm one of a long, long list. I mean, I really felt the only thing I was guilty of was wanting to be in People magazine, which, okay, guilty as charged, you know, take me away, lock me up. You know, because when you're a writer, and Lord knows the New York Times is never going to review your books, like, you take what you can get, and if that's People, then you're darn right, you know.
And more people read People than are likely to read the section, the literary section in the New York Times book review.
That's absolutely right. And, like, if people want you to post with a kid, you damn well post with your kid, and if you don't have a kid, you go borrow somebody else's.
Let's set the matter straight. Whose idea was the hot tub decision? Was that was People's?
They wanted a shot with Lucy. I picked the bath just because I knew that I'd be comfortable there and I knew she'd be comfortable there.
Okay.
And I liked it. I thought it was sort of fun and girly and glamorous, and like, when do you ever get a chance to like have a professionally lit picture, you know, of your kid and you in the bathtub and there's no like nipples showing?
Yeah.
I loved that
picture.
Plus
suds are pretty comfortable.
The suds were great. Yeah. It was warm. You know, we had the jacuzzi jets going. It was terrific. But I'm not always going to write about mothers. In fact, the book that I'm thinking about writing now, there are no kids. There are no kids. There are no husbands. There's very little romance. It's a story about a friendship. It's a story about, I've been thinking about this book for like 6 months now, and I just picked up a review of Mary Gateskill's new book, and I'm like, Jesus, she got there first. Again.
That's been getting raves, too.
Well, she's amazing. Yeah. I mean, she's really great. But it's a story of women who were friends from like second grade to 10th grade, like bosom friends. And they go away for the summer and they come back and one of them has grown 3 inches and gotten boobs and now becomes one of the high school's beautiful people and leaves her former best friend behind.
Ah.
And then we flash forward 20 years and the best friend is still living in the same town, still living in the same house. And it's the middle of the night and there's a knock on her door. And she opens the door, and there is this woman that she hasn't seen since high school graduation, and she's white as a sheet, and there's blood on the hem of her coat. And she says, "Something terrible's happened, and you're the only one who can help."
Wow.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
So no kids, no weddings. It's going to be very different and very dark.
Very mysterious,
Very
too.
Mysterious,
dark,
yes.
Too.
Dark.
Dark. Dark but observational.
Dark but observational. Yeah,
we have to come up with a bunch of qualifiers like that to sort of bridge the divide.
Well, I always wanted
X plus, but Y.
I wanted elegiac, and I'm never going to get it.
Yeah.
Fuck. You know, it's you know, well, I worked so hard in college.
Maybe there's the solution here is like to get like sort of a collected works of Jennifer Weiner with a sort of, you know, hardback, very, very nice vellum sort of thing sitting by the fire. And then like, it's no longer chiclet. It's my
God. I should just get like Alistair Cook or somebody to like do the books on tape.
Yeah.
Jennifer Weiner, good in bed.
Yes. Yeah. I looked at my husband.
Right. Yeah. Oh, listen, you know.
Well, so you don't really feel pigeonholed because of this, you know.
Needing to write about plus-size women or needing to write about mothers?
Both to some degree.
No, I think I can kind of do what I want at this point. I mean, I don't know if I could write a book about, like, a male serial killer. Mm. But my publisher really trusts me, mm-hmm. you know, and, like, I got the suckers to sign me up for a 3-book deal. So
They're
kind of, you know, I feel pretty free because I think my readers will follow me places.
Do you feel that you're sort of permitted to take chances and expose the wedgies in the
future?
Sort of volumes?
I do. I mean, I think the covers are a fight I'm always going to lose.
Yeah.
But I think the content, I can do what I want. Mm-hmm. Tell the stories I want to tell.
You said repeatedly in interviews that Cannie Shapiro was like, you know, the voice that was the closest to you personally.
Yes.
Now that was, you know, years ago.
7 years ago.
7 years ago, yeah. Yes. And a lot of people change a lot in 7 years. Do you still feel that way or is there another character who is?
Oh, I think that sort of that sarcasm is still kind of me. But I think that like Cannie was 28. And when you're 28, you're the center of your own universe. Mm-hmm. You care very much about, are you going to find a guy? Are you going to land in a career where you don't want to kill yourself having to go to work every day? Yeah. Your family embarrasses the hell out of you. I think that my characters, I think that Kate's a little more generous than Cannie was because she has people who depend on her in a way that Cannie didn't. So she's probably closer right now. Although I do not give my child cheese doodles and breath mints on a regular basis. And I would just like the listening public to know that.
Okay, cool. Tony Danza, you were on his show.
Yeah.
I'm very dubious of Tony Danza. Is he really a gentleman? Or?
He was so nice to me. I cannot
I've
even
tell you.
I've
been trying to explain the success of Tony Danza.
Well, I can't do that for you because I didn't watch Who's the Boss. I'm not familiar with him at all, really. Yeah. I mean, but I have to tell you, I've done a lot of talk shows, and he was really nice. You, like, go there, and he had all the dressing rooms set up with, like, people's names on them, and, like, he mm-hmm. gives you this gift basket with, like, 800 Altoids, and he wrote me a thank you note for being on the show.
Tony Danza himself.
Wow. On stationery that says, Tony Danza.
Wow.
It's on my refrigerator.
That's unprecedented.
It was completely unprecedented, because most of the time, it's like, yeah, see you, bye.
Yeah.
And especially being a novelist, it is damn hard to get on TV when you're a novelist.
Sure.
It's like if you're a mountain climber who has to chew your own arm off because you caught it in a crevasse. It's like everyone wants you and your hook. But, shit, did I just say that? Okay.
That's okay.
No, it's not because he's published by the same place that I am.
Oh, well.
Aaron Ralston, we love you.
No offense.
Yeah, no, but I think that like if there's a nonfiction angle to your book that, you know, it's like very easy. It's a hook and everybody wants you to come talk about your, you know, so Jennifer, you chewed your own arm off. But if you just write novels, it's like, so did this happen? It didn't? Yeah, okay, bye.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually had a producer from a prominent morning show that I will not name call me up and like, we're doing a show about weight and relationships and wasn't it terrible when your ex-boyfriend wrote those columns about you? And I'm like, no, that never happened. I made that up. The book, when it says novel, it means that there's made up stuff inside. Yeah. And they were like, do you know anyone where something like that did happen? And I'm like, bye-bye, you know?
You know, I talked to Paula Kamen, who had a similar sort of experience. She wrote this book called Out of My Head, where I'm not sure if you've heard of
but
it's about the constant headache that she had.
Yes, yes.
And she could not get booked by Katie Couric because there was no happy ending to her story.
Well,
can you
and
believe
also,
that?
Also, headaches just aren't visual.
Yes.
See, now, if she chewed her arm off because of the
exactly,
pain, then she would have been golden. But I know. I mean, I think that it's unfortunate in our sort of fragmented media society, you know, with the 500 channels of digital cable and everybody competing for airspace and for headspace, that writers have a hard time of it, which is why I think weblogs are so valuable and podcasting so valuable and sort of anything that reaches people that way is incredibly valuable because we're just not going to get on CNN most of the time.
Or C-SPAN, you can get on there. You can't get on C-SPAN. You can't get on Book TV?
They only do nonfiction.
I thought they've done like fiction, like they've done like little, they've done like the panels of BEA.
See, it's again with the I Need a Penis.
Oh.
Can you help me?
Yeah.
Can you help?
Okay, well, I'm going to go down. There's a guy.
Ed's going to give me a penis.
There's
goodbye.
There's a guy in the corner. He has a trench coat and he has these spare penises. Or if you go down to the tenderloin, you go down that hill. Yeah.
Oh, God.
One last question.
Sure.
So what's the story with Jezebel Bright?
Oh, talking about like the books where your publisher is like, are you sure you want to do that?
Yeah.
I never actually showed it to my publisher. My agent is the only one who's read it. Uh-huh. Jezebel Bright is a female superhero origin story set in a post-terrorist dystopic New York. It's 600 pages long. It's a mess. I finished it, and I'm putting it in a box to age like a fine wine.
Yeah.
In a box.
Yeah.
Box wine. I'll look at it someday again. I have a feeling that it's the kind of thing that's going to require a level of attention that I won't be able to give it until I'm like done childbearing and my kids are all in school.
Yeah.
So
it could also be a comic book like that.
That it's very much manga influenced. It's very influenced by graphic novels, which I love.
Yes.
And I love origin stories. I mean, what writer doesn't?
Yeah.
So that's what that is. And someday it will see the light of day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, thank you very much for being
here. This was awesome. Yes. This was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, shit. Oh, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Your mother, get up, come on, get down with